Welcome to Elite Wrestling Radio. I'm Hotshot Danny Duggan, and after a two-week hiatus, I am back on the air. We just posted a different interview of sorts, as we had 25-plus wrestlers on the CWE crew sit down with our producer, Kid Remington, backstage at the 5th anniversary show to talk about their memories and reflections of their time in Canadian Wrestling's Elite. If you haven't had a chance yet, check that out. It's a good insight into some of the everyday operations that is Canadian Wrestling's Elite. But we're back, and tonight we've got 20-plus year veteran of the sport and Manitoba wrestling icon, beautiful Bobby J, on the program to talk about his illustrious career, spanning from his wrestling career across the continent to his time promoting Top Rope Championship Wrestling to all kinds of fun stuff. So stay tuned to the program. Bobby will be coming on, and it promises to be a great interview. We just wrapped up the 5th anniversary show tour, the Masterpiece Theater Tour. Chris Masters was here for 5 days, and for anyone that got to be a part of those events, really saw some special wrestling over the 5 days of action across Manitoba. I sound like a broken record, but it's true. Each and every tour we've been doing, they just keep getting better and better. And the collection of wrestlers that performed for Canadian Wrestling's Elite over 5 days put on some spectacular events that's going to really shine through for some great TV on CWE TV over the next coming months. So make sure if you missed any of those events, or if you're only able to attend a few of them, stay tuned to CWE television to see some of the great wrestling that happened. Wrestlers came from Alberta, they came from North Dakota, West Virginia, Tennessee. There was Chris Masters and all the top stars of Canadian Wrestling's Elite, and it really produced some great wrestling over the span of the 5 days we operated. Chris Masters, a big thank you to him coming on out to Canadian Wrestling's Elite. You know, obviously he is talented. We know he's talented. He's been to the top of the mountain, but the matches that he came here and did 5 nights in a row were incredible. He did not come here and phone it in. He came in here, he put his working boots on, and each and every night went balls out. Whether it was in Neepawa, Manitoba, Beausejour, or Winnipeg, he worked hard and produced some really good wrestling television for us during his stay. Sigmund debuted from Knoxville, Tennessee, another great performer. Jason Kincaid, another great performer. And if you didn't get, like I said, if you didn't get a chance to check these guys out, stay tuned to CWE TV, as we're in for some special stuff over the next couple months. Overall, reflections from the tour, it was a great tour. We ran 5 shows in 5 days, and each and every tour we've ran, we've seen improvement in the markets we're going to. Some of the markets have been a tough start for us to get off the ground and get going, whether that be from previous operations that were in the town or otherwise. There's been a couple obstacles that have kind of prevented us to get us where we want to be, but we're finally breaking down those obstacles, moving through those barriers, and making something happen in these towns. And people in rural Manitoba are finding out what the people of Winnipeg have known for 5 years. CWE is Canada's fastest growing entertainment alternative. And the response from a lot of these markets was great. CWE was featured in most of the newspapers going in to the tour, and were then featured in all of them after the tour. And all the towns are buzzing, and we're back with our next tour. We're upgrading. We just did 5 shows in 5 days. We're going to upgrade to 6 shows in 6 days, May 6th through 11th. And this is going to include the inclusion of Souris, Manitoba on our tour loop. And this is, of course, going to be headlined by Ring of Honor star Chris Hero. And there's been a lot of buzz since the announcement of Chris Hero, and the match possibilities are endless. So if you thought, I just talked about how good the CWE TV is going to be over the next 3 months, we're going to have Chris Hero here for 6 tapings. So it's only going to get that much better as we move into 2014. So stay tuned, CWECanada.ca. All the tour information is going to start to come to fruition here as we get a little bit closer to the date. But before then, we've got some stops here in Winnipeg. The CWE schedule is not slowing down. We're back. Rookie Sports Bar, Friday, March 21st. And this is our first event at Rookie since our last one in January, which was our biggest one to date. So we're expecting big things as we go into the springtime. Friday night, March 21st, 8:30 bell time, 18-plus event. You can drink booze, come down with your friends. It's an adult environment, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Matches are going to start to be announced over the coming days, so stay tuned to our website. Stay tuned to our Facebook, CWE Wrestling, or on Twitter at CWE Canada for those match announcements as they come to be. Blake Broadway, Mr. Incredible, Man are going to be coming on up from North Dakota. They'll be here a part of that big event. I'll be participating. A-list Anderson Tyson Moore has announced that he will be defending his 123 approved.ca TV championship on this event. For the first time ever, CWE Tag Team Champion Nate Hardy will be appearing at a rookies event and many, many more. So it's going to be an action-packed night of wrestling. And then just 2 weeks later, we're not done yet. We're going to go back in for another 18-plus event, this time at Club St. B for our first event ever at the building. It has hosted many wrestling operations over the years, but this will be the first time Canadian Wrestling's Elite steps foot in Club St. B in St. Boniface, just down the street from our home venue, Holy Cross Gymnasium Hall, for an 18-plus event. And this is on Sunday, April 6th. This is a special day of professional wrestling action, as it's going to be CWE Wrestling from 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday afternoon. And as soon as that's wrapped up, WWE WrestleMania will hit the screens in the Club St. Boniface Hotel. So CWE Wrestling, WWE WrestleMania, all for the price of one. So if you're hoping to catch WrestleMania, it just got a whole lot sweeter for you. Come down to Club St. B, watch some CWE, then join the stars of Canadian Wrestling's Elite, have some drinks, and enjoy WrestleMania. Club St. B is the host of our official after parties after our TV tapings here in Winnipeg. We've built a really good relationship with them, and we're really excited to host our first and hopefully first of many events at their establishment. CWE TV returns this Friday. This will be the second episode that airs from some of the footage that was filmed and taped during the Masterpiece Theater tour, and it's a big episode. In the main event, we've got Kamikaze, Western Canada's greatest high flyer, getting in the ring with the rabid dog, Rob Stardom, who will have the mastermind Kevin Cannon in his corner. Also scheduled, that same man that's going to defend his title at Rookies, Anderson Tyson Moore, is going to defend his TV championship against super friend JJ Sanchez. And Sigmund, a man who debuted last week on Canadian Wrestling's Elite TV, defeating the first All-Star Brian Rich, has his work cut out for him. He's got a lot bigger of an opponent this week when he challenges the Mohican Sun, Jess Youngblood. And this week's TV episode will feature the debut of former NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champion, Jason Kincaid. We knew we were getting some special talent with those guys, and they really exceeded our expectations. So tune in, watch Sigmund, watch Jason Kincaid, and watch all the stars of Canadian Wrestling's Elite. And for those in Winnipeg that catch us in time, we just talked about WWE WrestleMania. The Road to WrestleMania tour is stopping in at the MTS Center in Winnipeg, Manitoba. CWE has been working hand in hand with World Wrestling Entertainment to help promote this event through social media, and we're very excited to have built that relationship with them. We've been doing some giveaways on our social media, so if you'd like an opportunity at those, go to our website. All the information is there. Go to our Facebook page, CWE Wrestling, for some information on how you can win some tickets to the MTS Center event, the Road to WrestleMania. Daniel Bryan, The Wyatts, The Shield, Batista, John Cena, all the stars will be in Winnipeg this Friday night, and in attendance will be all the Canadian Wrestling's Elite stars. So come and join them and take in this event for what's going to be an incredible night of professional wrestling action. We're going to take a quick break here, catch my breath, have some water, and we're going to get the legend himself, a beautiful Bobby J, on the line for a one-on-one in-depth interview. Stay tuned. And we're back on Elite Wrestling Radio, and on the line now, I have Manitoba wrestling icon, 20-plus year veteran of the sport, beautiful Bobby J, on the line. How you doing, Bobby?
I'm doing great, Danny. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm excited to have you on the line. You're a man that's always full of fun and full of stories. I think we're going to have an interesting hour.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Shoot away.
All right. Well, we're going to get this thing started. Let's start right from the very beginning of the journey of beautiful Bobby J. How did you begin your journey in professional wrestling?
Well, I guess as a young kid, I was a big fan of the AWA. I used to go to the arena and watch it. Actually, I guess I should tell Bernie Gondi this, but we used to buy one ticket, and I'd go pump the doors, and we'd all sneak in, so we'd all get it for $4, and we'd sit there and watch the shows, and had a great time. So, I was an entrepreneur back in the day as a 13-year-old.
So. Something I'm sure some people did to you when you started running your promotion years later.
Oh, I'm sure that's why I'm not running any more promotions anymore. Yeah, so anyway, I used to love wrestling, so... As I got older, I was always a really small kid in school. Like, I was always, when you take pictures with in school, they're always the kid next to the teacher, the shortest boy. That was always me. So I was always a little guy, but I still loved wrestling. And then as I got older, I started, I guess I grew to about 5'8", 5'9". So I guess I'm not on the tall side. I'm quite short, but not a midget by any means. And I started working out a bit, and I still, my love for wrestling still was there. I used to go to watch New Brown Wrestling in Chalmers, because that was actually my home community center. I went to Elmwood High School, which was across the street, and my chaps, they used to have enough wrestling there, so it was awesome. I used to go watch. I'd see Caveman Broda, Walter Shevchuk, who eventually got me into the business. There was Frank Starr, a very young Dave Petro, who just started out. He's my age, but he started when he was like 15 or 16. So he was there, and I used to go to the shows there all the time. And then another guy that I went to school with, Bad Boy Brian Jules, who ended up being my tag team partner down the road. I went to high school with him, and he was performing on those shows. So it was kind of cool. And then it got to the point where I really wanted to be a wrestler, but I figured I was too short, because back in like 88, 89, that was right when Hulk Hogan and all the guys were in there in WWE, and that's what you saw on TV. And they were all 6'8", 6'5", jacked up. I'm a 5'8" guy, but I started working out and started getting in shape. But I never thought I'd be a wrestler. And then one day when we went to a WWE house show, it was WWF back in the day, I had a very striking resemblance to Marty Jannetty. Like, everybody thought I was Marty Jannetty. And now we were at the Polo Park Inn after the show, and people were asking, all the merch were asking for autographs from the wrestlers, and some came up to me and were asking for autographs. And so I'm like, I'll pretend I'm Marty Jannetty. So I was signing autographs, and and then even the, like, Nasty Boys are sitting at a table having beers, and they were like, "Hey, Marty!" They're all, and then all the workers were all calling me Marty. And then Marty Jannetty came in, and we had a beer together, and we had a chuckle. And then I went to another. Then I was at that point, I still thought I was too small, but I thought, "Hey, people have actually thought I was a wrestler." So then I went to a Tony Candelo show. Actually, I should backtrack. Back in the day when we used to, when we were in high school, we used to do like backdrops onto the high jump pits, so like those big mats and stuff like that. We do like matches in the hallways, and when we went to AWA, we would. Am I babbling too long, or is this good?
No, this is more than fine, Bob. Let's hear it.
So once I get on a roll here, I can't stop talking. But anyway, so yeah, so backtrack a bit. In AWA, when they have the shows, we'd have actually matches in the corridors. Me and my buddies just joke around, and all the fans be watching and cheering and joking around, and we were actually quite believable. Like, people would actually, "Oh, you guys are pretty good." And then the one time we went to a Tony Cadello show at Club Taboo, it was just before I got into business, me and a buddy got pretty hammered up to the bar, and we started just joking around wrestling, like, in intermission. And then people come up and say, "You guys are better than those guys in the ring. You should be wrestlers, eh?" And so I'm thinking to myself, I think I should give this a shot, eh? So I went to Tony Cadello one day. There was some guy, he came into the bar I was working at. I was working at a place called Spanky's Bar, and he said he was a wrestler, so he brought me down to see Tony Candelo. I guess he had heat with Tony at the time. And so Tony says, "Yeah, I want $2,500 all up front, and then we'll train you, and we'll see, no guarantees." And I said, "Yeah, why don't Brian Jewell?" But Brian Jewell had just gotten fired from Tony, so that was I had two guys with heat that I said I knew. And so I guess Tony just wanted to highball me or whatever. And so, I was kind of deterred at that point, because I didn't have much money. And then someone said they saw an ad in the paper saying that there's a wrestling promotion starting, they needed wrestlers, and they would train. So I called it up. It was actually Walter Shevchuk, who was Full Man John Shaw when I used to watch wrestling, and then he was called Superstar back in the New Brand days. And so I met up with him, and I gave him $200, and he showed me a lockup. It's like, "Kid, you're ready to go."
So what was the training like back then to compare to how it's done now?
Well, I was kind of an exception, because I guess I was kind of a backyarder before there was backyard wrestling, and I actually wasn't too bad at what I, like, I used to do all the goofy stuff with my friends, so I actually learned most of my stuff on the fly. Like I said, Walter showed me to tie up, and I got in there. I did a show at the Merchants Hotel in December of 1990, and I wasn't ready yet, but they just threw me in there. And then a guy named Terry Tomko, who was called The Frog, he's a son of the legendary promoter El Tomko, he basically took me under his wing, and he would get me to do training stuff. We set up the ring at the Cavalier Hotel. We did lots of shows there, and I was actually working there at that point. And he would show me some stuff there. And then I took to his basement a couple times and did some stuff. And we just, I just kind of learned on the fly. So my training wasn't as extensive as most people's. I just kind of learned on the fly.
Very early in your career, you started to receive opportunities with the World Wrestling Federation at the time, doing some job matches for them. How did you get that opportunity, being so green and so new to the business, and what are some of your memories of those matches?
Well, what happened was I was working, my first few months I worked with Walter Shevchuk and Terry Tomko, and I guess Terry Tomko didn't like me for some reason after a while, so I have my hunches why, but I'm not going to get into it on here. I'm sure you might know why too, but he didn't like me so after a while, so I went to work for Tony Condello, and at the time Bulldog Bob Brown was the booker, and they were doing some two TV tapes, I guess Winnipeg and Brandon in 1992, or like in September 1992. So they got a hold of, I guess, Tony or Bob or both, and asked if they had any hands that could come and do some jobs, and I can. And Bob had approached me and asked me if I could do it, and I said, of course. And so I did it, and I guess I had a lot of fun at it. I got squashed, and I was very green, and in my first match, I actually screwed up a clothesline bump, and they had to redo the thing over again, and then they just edited it for TV, and it looked fine on TV.
Who were some of the people you worked with in those matches?
Well, the first night I was in Winnipeg, I worked with Money Incorporated, which is Ted DiBiase, and IRS, with Jimmy Hart in the corner, and I teamed with Jim Powers. And that was, and then the second night, we were Brandon, and that was an abortion of a match. I can't believe it aired, but the magic of editing on television. It was me and some guy named Bill Lyons out of Minneapolis. I guess some Minneapolis guys came up to do TV jobs, too. We worked against High Energy, Coco Beware, and Owen Hart. And the match ended just a debacle, because originally I wasn't supposed to take the pin, breaking Kate Baker, but I wasn't supposed to take the pin. My partner was. And there was one spot in there where I guess I used to go under the leapfrog, get a hip toss, and I was defeated for a hip toss. And then when he was going under the leapfrog, he fell and he started crawling towards the ropes. The whole crowd started laughing. So then he just comes walking in, they blind, and then Coco Beware comes in, and I come in, and Coco goes, what are you doing in here, kid? I'm there. I'm supposed to be in here. He just gives me a work shot, and says, get out. And so then Owen Hart, if you see on the, I've actually got the tape, where Owen Hart actually elbows him right in the face. He's pissed off with him or whatever, and the guy was bleeding. And then the ref comes and says, you're taking the pin, kid. And luckily I knew what the finish was, because they tagged me in, and I finished the match with them, and then they thanked me in the back, but I guess they weren't too happy with it. And I, at that point, thought, there's no way this is going to air, but they edited everything out, and it looked fine on television, which was amazing. So I did those two matches. That was Winnipeg and Brandon, and I guess who else on the show is Brian Jewell from Winnipeg, I guess The Machine, or Jason Henderson, or Jason Powers, he was on there too. And I might add that Jason Powers is undefeated. He did one match, and the Nasty Boys got disqualified, so we always joke around and he's undefeated in WWE. That's, I guess, it works.
So what was it like working with some of those guys, like Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, Irwin R. Scheisser, guys that are in the prime of their career? What was that like, being such a young kid in the business, getting to work with such big stars?
Well, you know, it was kind of weird, because I thought that I was going to make, like, back then I didn't know better. Like, there was no internet. I didn't realize there was a million workers out there. And when Walter Shevchuk took my $200, he popped my tires and said, oh, in a few months, you'll be in WWF, no problem. You'll be in New York working with Vince. You got the look, blah, blah, blah. So I thought it was a natural progression. Because within a year of being in the business, I got to work for Tony. I got to work on top and a lot of main events with him. And I got to go on his television, and they were putting me over on television. I thought, oh, it's just a natural step, and away I go. But then I realized really quickly that I wasn't even close to ready. But it was still an experience that I'll never forget. Ted DiBiase, he was so nice to me. Every time he saw me, because I did these two shows, I did two more, 3 weeks later in Regina and Saskatoon. And every time he saw me, he pat me on the back, say, hey, kid, and all this. He was just so nice to me. But I saw that all the guys were just really down to earth, and it was a really cool experience with them. But at the time, I didn't realize how cool of an experience it was going to be, because I thought I was going to end up there. And little to my regrets, I never had a chance. My big hopes was to be a tag team with Marty Jenny, because we looked so much alike and that, but it just never happened.
Well, many promoters have promoted you as a former WWF star, so it's like you were there anyways.
Well, yes. The one local guy named Easy Rider said that he refused to do it. He said it would be bad for his career. Well, I think we both went about the same distance in the career, but I still, to this day, can go on YouTube and show people, look at this. I was in the WWE. They go, cool. Even though I got my ass kicked.
So you mentioned the name Brian Jewell. It was in the early to mid-90s. You actually formed a tag team with Brian. How did that tag team come to be?
Actually, I think it was Doug McCall who was booking for Wayne and for River City Wrestling. And he came up to me with and Brian with the idea of saying that we got television and we want to team you guys up and give you a push as a tag team. So we just said, sure, we'll run with it. And I was the charismatic heat seeker, and he was the mean dude with him, a very good technician, great bumper. So I would do my thing with the crowd. He'd take all the bumps, and we blended together and made a really good tag team.
What are some of your memorable feuds and opponents from that time?
Actually, when Brian Jewell ended up, I turned on Brian Jewell. We had a really good feud. That was a really good one. And we had some good matches with Dave Petro and Mike Stone. Except they used to party quite a bit in the back before the matches. So some of the matches may not have been back classics, but they sure were a lot of fun.
In the mid-90s, actually the early 90s, a young man by the name of Vance Nevada broke onto the scene, and it was very quickly after that that he started to get put into roles of importance with the company he was working for. What was it like working for a young Vance Nevada when he was booking for these companies?
It's all right. Vance was always so dedicated to his sport. And I remember when he first broke in, a lot of the older veterans, like, they were old school guys, and they didn't like the young, skinny, good-looking kid. And back then, Vance was a very good-looking kid. And they didn't like him, and they really gave him a rough time. But I remember one time something happened, and I think he ran a show out of town, and something happened. He couldn't pay everybody, and they were just so mean to him. And then they were really trying to bury him on TV. And I took him aside and I said, you know what? Don't worry about it, kid. Just keep doing your thing, and things will pass, and hopefully things will work out for you. And he ended up having a great career, and I owe a lot to Matt Savada, actually. He did a lot for me when I was running TRCW, and he's now retired, and it's too bad, because he was really a good worker, and he was really into the business, and a good historian, and he's going to be with us. And this is going to miss Matt Savada, for sure.
What were your first impressions of Vance? Were you one of those people that were on the fence about him, giving him a hard time, or did you form a relationship with him rather quickly?
You know what? I never gave anyone a hard time. Like, I'm always kind of like, because I was like a small kid in school, and I wasn't one of the cool clique as a kid, so I was kind of like the underdog. So to see someone like that, you know, getting picked on, I kind of felt bad for him, actually. And same with anybody, like Louis, like, you know, like if Forrest Fosmer the third, like, I'll always be nice to him, because a lot of people just aren't nice to people like that, and I have a soft spot for people that get picked on, and I don't like that. When the guys were picking on him, I didn't like that at all. It wasn't cool in my books.
Well, some people like to give Vance Nevada a hard time because he broke a man by the name of Ernie Todd into the business, and you worked for Ernie Todd when he broke into the business in 1996. What are some of your memories of the formation of the Canadian Wrestling Federation and Ernie Todd's involvement?
Back when he first started, I wasn't really wrestling much, because my baseball league that I started had just taken off, and I opened up my bar for a while, so I didn't really work much with him. And then he started off, he's running a few shows, and when I was working for him, he barely ran any shows, so I didn't have much recollection with him. I know he always paid me what I was promised, but he never really turned really weird until I started running. That's when I guess, had a competitive edge, and he would do some stupid things as well as I did. And that was really started after I stopped working for him. But as far as when I worked for him, he was always treating me fairly, and he gave me a run as a champion as well. And so as far as I'm actually working for him before PRCW, I don't have really anything negative to say about him. There's some negativity once we're running head-to-head, of course, because we were pretty bitter rivals for quite a while there. But, well, the early formation of CWF, it was another company, and I just took some matches for them, and that was about it.
In 1999, River City Wrestling decided to relaunch, and that's Wayne Stanton's brand. You were working for the Canadian Wrestling Federation at the time, if I'm not mistaken, when that launched. What prompted you to make the decision to leave Ernie and start working for Wayne's Upstart Group?
Well, it was right at that time where I had my bar. I had a bar in 1999, but it closed down in around November of 1999. And that's right about the time when Wayne started up, and Ernie was only running like maybe a 3, 4, 5, I could be wrong, but very rarely, like a couple times a year maybe a month, or that I knew of anyway, because I wasn't really working at that time. And then I wanted to get back into it. I wanted to, like, kind of not make a comeback, but just start working a lot of shows. And then I found it to Wayne, who I knew from the River City days, and then I always have a soft spot in my heart for him too, because he gave me a big push on TV a few years back. He was running, so I went and checked him out at Bumpers. Bumper's Bar, and I saw a bunch of these young kids. I saw a lot of potential in them, and I went up to Wayne and said, Wayne, would you be interested in using me? And he goes, well, don't you have a contract with Ernie Todd? I said, well, I do. He goes, well, why don't you just wait? I think it was supposed to end in like early 2000, like January 2000. And this was like probably November. So he said, why don't you just wait over the next couple months and then wait your contract so there's no heat? And I said, yeah, you know, I might as well do that. And of course, Ernie didn't run any shows anyway, so I just sat around. And once I got to work with Wayne, there was all these young kids who were like unbelievable. The talent that was there.
Is there anyone in particular that stands out that you saw a lot of potential in during that original class?
Will Damon and Shane Madison were the two. Shane had the look. He was called Jeff Wallace, his own shoot name back then. And Playboy Will Damon, when he was on the microphone, he would crack me up because it was at a bar show. I'd be having a few beers, and anything goes in a bar show. So he had me laughing all the time. And that, you know me, I like to be entertained when I'm doing my matches. I want to entertain people. When I'm watching a match, I love people to work the crowd and just entertain me as a fan. People don't like to say that they're fans of wrestling as a wrestler, but I am a wrestling fan, and if you want to call me Mark, so be it. I still love to watch wrestling. I'm actually going to go to the WWE show on the weekend, and that's the two guys that really stuck out to me, and of course Wayne's always was comical on the stick. So once we got went over there. Wayne says to me, I'm thinking of selling to Ernie Todd. You gotta be kidding me. I just got heat with Ernie now because I just left him and he's all pissed off with me. And I said, you know what? I've got money. I said, how much do you want for your ring? So he gave me a price. I said, you know what? How about I buy the ring and I take over? So he goes, okay. So we signed some papers. I guess they weren't through lawyers. We just made up an agreement. So I think I need a lawyer's agreement with him just to buy a ring because we've been friends for many years. And then I went and bought a ring truck, and next thing you know, I call him up, say, Wayne, I'm coming to get the ring now, and I got your money. He goes, wow, I got a problem. I kind of sold Mercedes Wrestling to Ernie Todd. What are you talking about? So I just find out that Wayne is not very good.
So you got swerved.
Yeah, so I got swerved, so I was thinking to myself, what the hell? I bought this big milk truck to be my ring truck, and I've got the money ready to go. And so then me and Bass actually had a talk, and he goes, you know what, on the internet, the Ernie Todd's been daring everybody. He said, I don't think anybody would really want to work for him. I said, we've got to, you know what, I could get some plans, and I could get a ring built in like a month or two. You think the guys would work for me? And so we had a meeting, and everybody said, yep. They're pretty much in. So then Wayne made his deal with Ernie, and I guess Ernie had a big crew meeting for the whole crew to come down and do the merger. And I guess Rob Stardom showed up, and anyone else, and me. and then I guess the crew from the CWF. And then Ernie turned to me and goes, "Well, Bobby, are you planning to start up?" And I said, "I'm not sure yet." Because at that point, my ring wasn't set up yet. It was on the process, but I wasn't lying to him. I said, I'm not sure yet. He looked right at me because he heard that I was wanting to buy the ring off Wayne, and that had fell through. So,
you showed up to the meeting with the knowledge you were going to be starting up just to kind of get a feel for what was going on with the Ernie and Wayne merger?
Correct.
Okay.
So I was invited. Everybody was invited, including me, so I took up the invitation. It's not like I crashed the party. I was invited, so I came.
So shortly after that, you did make the announcement that Top Rope Championship Wrestling would be forming. What was the reaction to Ernie Todd and his crew when this announcement was made?
Well, I never really talked to Ernie's crew ever. It was Ernie that was very hot about it. He would go on the internet and bash our crew. And just, I don't know, he was just very negative towards it. And but we started off, we moved forward, and racked quite a few shows and had a good time with it.
You talked about yourself and Ernie both pulling some dirty tactics during that war between TRCW and CWF. What were some of the shenanigans that were going on during this infamous war in the early 2000s?
Let's see. On my part, I only did one bad thing. And Bernie probably doesn't even know this, but it's coming. It's breaking news now. They were having a fast. Well, I'll tell you what I did first, and I'll tell you some of the things he did afterwards. But he was having a fan spring of weapons battle royals at the Keystone Center, and I kind of called them and let them know that people were going to be walking in with weapons into the show, and I think it got kiboshed. So, but that's legit, though. I wasn't lying. So, but that was out there. Like, I was going to start off this gimmick where you do a wrestling show and then follow it up with a social at the hall. So you get the hall, you rent the hall for a social, for wrestling on from 7 to 9, and then they clear the ring out, and it's a social with dancing, you sell booze throughout the whole thing. Then you pony in the rent for the building, it's a social cost, and it would work out really good. So Ernie kept calling the liquor commissions, because with an occasional permit, you're not supposed to be selling tickets at the door or advertising it, which a lot of people don't know. Like, if you have a wedding social, you're not supposed to put it on Facebook. But the liquor commission, they turn a blind eye to that. They always do. But Ernie kept calling and calling. They got to the point where they said, look, we know you're bending the rules here. So they said, we'll make a deal with you. You can't sell booze during their show, but as soon as the wrestling show is over, you can call it a social and then sell your booze. So that killed everything, because, of course, a lot of people left after the wrestling, and that killed that idea, so I never tried it again. We drew a packed house at Park City West that night. But Ernie did that. Then he used to get his crew mad at me. One time, I guess, we just started at the Palladium, which was a university bar, and a lot of people go to the university. So I was posting like all the polls at the University of Manitoba. So I guess he ran a show at the Beer Bash there, and so he had posters up, but I put my posters like underneath his, like not covering his, but right underneath his, but in the same areas. And he got Spider out to me saying that I was covering his posters, which was not true at all. Spider came up to me right now. I went to watch the show at the Beer Bash to check it out, because I'd always go check the other shows out for the towns to see what's going on and to be in the know of what's happening locally. And Spider came up and he basically wanted to kill me, and luckily he didn't, because he was very mad at me. And to this day we laugh about it, but he was sicking Spider on me, and he used to get Derek Dalton mad at me over stuff. What he would do, I guess he would say stuff that I would say, and it was not always true, of course, because they were all my friends at one point. I was in the locker room, and I just moved on, and he would try and scoop my venues, undercut my venues as well. I had a guarantee the Cavalier, and he went in and said they all work off the gate, and I had a guarantee that was pretty good for local standards without bringing in names, and he went in and said he'd work off the gate, and so I lost. They said, why would we pay you guys some out when it's not like covering the gate, when he'll do it for free, and then we'll get free revenue out of it. So he did that as well. There's other stuff, but
so just some back and forth banter that kind of burnt the business a little bit.
Oh, I don't know how bad it burnt the business. It's just made for unpleasant times for everybody. But you know what? He did light a fire under me by doing this too, because it made me work a lot harder to try to show Ernie Todd by going out and getting all these shows and trying to draw good houses and stuff.
So on that note, what are some of the highlights and positive memories of Top Rope Championship Wrestling? Looking back, what are some of the more memorable moments you can take from that time of operation?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm a major hand in the development of a lot of the young talent that was there at that time. Probably about 20 guys broke in right at that exact time. And I was running about 10 to 12 shows a month, most of them in town where nobody had to go anywhere. They could still go to their day jobs if they had one. And get a lot of experience. So I was really proud of the fact that a lot of guys were able to break in or have just broken their business and get a lot of experience through me. A lot of people, I don't know how many appreciate that, but looking back, I think some do and maybe some don't. Some of them are just worried about how much they were getting paid. And so some people were bitter that they weren't making $1 million, but who does locally anyway? But I think my best claim to fame, I guess it's kind of infamous, is I had booked Davey Boy Smith to do a couple of matches with his son Harry, who's now David Hart Smith, or I guess British Bulldog Junior. He was in the WWE for a while, but they got to do a couple tag team matches here in Winnipeg and in Brandon. But unfortunately, he passed away a week later, not even like 5 days later. But he was such a nice guy, and he was going to help me out so much, and he was so appreciative of having Harry as his partner. And that was the only time they actually got to team up with us in Winnipeg and in Brandon. It was so unfortunate when he passed away.
Was the plan to do regular business with Davey Boy?
He was going to help me out. He was going to get some other names, and I was going to try and do a lot of shows with him, but it just didn't work out, unfortunately.
you tried to run many shows with some bigger names, like Tatanka also came in, Jim Neidhart. I remember there being a time that you had Chris Candido and Sonny booked, and they didn't end up making it to Winnipeg. What was the story behind their no-show?
Well, it was the first time I had a book that was, it was a month before the show that I actually had Davey Boy Smith on it. I had got a hold of them, and I didn't even really want Chris Candido. I just wanted Sonny, but they were a package deal because they were either married or they were together. So I booked them to do it, but they wanted a deposit and their plane tickets. And so I sent out a $200 deposit each, and I sent them their plane tickets, or their, I guess, itinerary, and paid for it. And they were supposed to do a show at a Double Fun Club. It was an adult-only show, which was perfect, so they could really do some risque stuff with Sonny, which is what people would want to see. So they were all set to go, and then I go to the airport the day of the show, and they're not there. I kept trying to get a hold of them, call them, and they finally said, we missed our flight, so we won't be able to make it. We're so sorry, but we'll do the next one. It's like, whatever. So I said, okay, well, here's our next one. But I was really pissed. I had a feeling I'm getting worked here. So we set it up to do the show. I guess about a month later, 6 weeks later, whatever. And it was going to be at South Dakota Community Center, as an all ages show for the carnival. And that's when I had Davey Boy Smith booked. It was actually that day of the show when I was scrambling to talk again, the Road Warrior Animals number. And I was going to fly him in from Minneapolis, but he couldn't do it. So he gave me Dave Boy Smith's number, and that's how I got that. Dave Boy Smith, I got his number from Johnny Devine. That was it, sorry. But yeah, I got a Road Warrior Animal to try and cover that show, but he couldn't do it on such late notice. There's no way he could get in. But anyway, so Chris Candido and Sonny, they said they would do the next show, and everything was all good. So I changed her plane tickets, costed me extra money, whatever. And so then 2 days before, I was talking to her on the phone, and she was just wasted. Like, I mean, just wasted. Like, and she goes, oh, we're double booked in Boston. We can't make it, but is there anything I can do? I said, I already had you set up to do an interview on TV or on the Joy Ellis radio show. She said, well, can I call him and I'll explain to it and you can put it on the air? So I guess she left him this voicemail and he phoned me right away. He goes, oh my God, Bobby, was that really, really her? I said, yes, it was. He said, I can't hear that. Like, she was just wasted, so I guess that's when she still had her drug problems, or I don't know if she still does or whatever, but she admitted she had drug problems back then, and she was just out of it, so they didn't make the show, and then I just gave up, and I said I wasn't going to use them again, I wasn't going to bother with it, and I kept on trying to get a hold of them to say, send me my money and my plane ticket money back, and then they would answer my voicemails. So finally, when I sent in my press release out to everywhere, I buried them. I totally buried them, and I guess I made it in Dusty Observer and whatever, telling basically the story I've just told on the air here. And then Chris Candido calls me out of nowhere, and he says, if you still talking about me, I'm going to come to Winnipeg, and I'm going to break your fucking legs. Sorry for the language. That's what he said. I said, you got to be kidding me. I said, well, just give you my money back. And then he said, you're not getting your money back, blah, blah, blah. And I never heard from him again then. It's very, very weird and strange and ironic that he broke his leg, got a blood clot, and died from it after he threatened to break my leg. It's kind of weird. I don't want to say karma, because I never wish that on anybody, but it's weird that that's how he passed away, after he threatened to break my legs. It's crazy.
Yeah, the world of wrestling promoting comes with some good stories and some bad ones, and that's definitely a negative story. You were very hands-on with Top Rope Championship Wrestling. As you mentioned, you were running 10 to 12 shows a month, which must have kept you very busy. As a promoter myself, I know running even one or two, three shows a month can be very stressful at times. Who are some of the key people that were helping you? Did you have different bookers throughout the time in TRCW? You know, Vance Nevada, was he your original booker?
Yeah, Vance was my original booker until he moved away. He did most of the stuff, and he was very hands-on. And to this day, I still say I did not appreciate it. I didn't realize how much he did for me. And how little I paid him until after it was all over, and I to this day I always apologize about that I didn't treat him a bit better than I probably should have, and he should have been getting a lot more money than he did. He was my main go to guy, and then after he left, I kind of did a lot of the booking myself, and then I had Johnny Malibu do it. I guess Shane Mathis tells the story how I had Johnny Malibu book him, but pretty much the whole crew turned on him because I for a while I had Mike Davidson actually book me too, but then me and him had a falling out. And the way I looked at it, Mike was trying to put riffs in it, play people against each other, dress you, and I didn't like that, because I talked earlier about having the underdog people, like I'm the fan of the underdog, and I don't agree with people getting picked on or being looked down on, and he really put some riffs in it, dress you. He was a great mind, though, he had some good ideas, but I just couldn't have that in my dress you, and so when I fired him, and if he kind of made that public at the Palladium, and it ended up turning into an angle, a shoot angle, that we did later on, but I had Johnny Malibu, and at the end, I was just booking it on my own, and then at the end, I saw the writing on the wall, and I had to close down. There was many reasons why I closed down, but I can get into it in a while, but is there any more questions you want
to ask? Yeah, before we get to that, Vance Nevada, Mike Davidson, they are cousins. They have a very heated, and it can be at times a very public, heated rivalry between the two of them. So I'm going to put you on the spot right here. Who was the better booker for business? Was it Mike Davidson or was it Vance Nevada?
Both were equal in my opinion. Like Mike Davidson will tell you, business was booming at the plate because of his booking. But he was also the booker of Valley Gardens. He was the booker of Doubles. He went down to zero people. And at Chalmers, he was the booker of all that. One venue exploded, and I think it was just the timing was right, the place was right, and so for him to say that he brought the business to the Palladium, I say the whole team brought the business to Palladium as well. It was the timing, it was the place was right. So he was a good booker, but so was that. I say they both did good business for me, as good as you could hope, running an oversaturated market in Winnipeg at that time.
So if you were to start up a promotion tomorrow, who would you give the call to first, Vance Nevada or Mike Davidson?
Depends on what I was looking for. If I was looking for a long-term, like working with locals and doing a lot of long-term angle stuff, I'd probably go with Vance, but Mike's got a lot of connections with names and stuff. So if I was running like on a bigger scale with a lot of names, I'd probably go with Mike.
Fair enough. So before TRCW ended, before we get to that portion of your career, you know, you had that big war with Ernie Todd and the Canadian Wrestling Federation, and eventually there came a point where the top portion of Ernie's crew actually decided to leave the CWF and come to Top Rope Championship Wrestling. How did this deal get brokered?
Well, it was pretty funny because actually, I guess Ernie had sent me an email earlier today saying that a whole bunch of people were pissed off with me from the stuff I was doing, and so some of the boys are going to come and pay me a visit one time. And that was like the day that they actually showed up at the Palladium. And then that night, they all show up and they're like, oh, fuck, what's happening tonight? They don't start no shit. Then all of a sudden, they came and approached me and asked me, said that they really like the setup here and they like the crew. And Ernie ain't really doing much and they'd love to jump on board. So I was like, they're all good workers. And me, I have to admit, I was all about burying Ernie Todd, so I don't care if it was the worst guy or the best guy. I was taking him just to try and to screw with Ernie.
What was the locker room environment like, bringing the guys you were going to war with? Robbie Royce, Darren Dalton, Assisted Suicide, all these guys that you were going head-to-head with, you know, probably weren't saying the nicest of things about your promotion and vice versa. What was the locker room like when everybody got in there and had to work together?
To my face, I never heard nothing. Next to nothing. I know Shane Madison said a little bit to me, but other than that, nobody really said much to me. They just, I guess, they probably talked amongst themselves a lot, but no one really came to me much about it. They just, it was whatever, just business as usual for me. And afterwards, I heard there was a few people who were upset, but as a businessman, trying to run a promotion and having competition out there, I did what I think was best for business. At that time, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was, I don't know, but I just did what I thought was best.
Do you think you were able to maximize the talent from the Canadian Wrestling Federation coming over to its max potential with the war that was going on? Were you able to capitalize on that?
I don't know. They play good matches and that, so I guess so. It was just I touched a big crew and everybody wanted to be on that Palladium show. It was tough. People don't understand how hard it was for me to keep everybody happy. When you have 25, 30 guys, and they all want to be on that one show, and nobody wants to work on the Chalmers show, or the Valley Garden show, or the Morris Place show, or the Double show that had gone downhill, it was tough. It was impossible to keep everybody happy. So as far as maximizing them, it was hard to maximize hardly anyone. You had your two or three big angles going. And other than that, everyone was just in undercard stuff, just getting their matches in. So it's hard to say.
Well, eventually things got a little too hot to handle. You fired Mike Davidson as booker of Top Rope Championship Wrestling, which ultimately led to his decision to start up his own promotion, Premier Championship Wrestling. Where were you, and how did you hear about the formation of this new group?
Who was it that? Actually, the first person to tell me was Vince Austin had sent me a message. He was working with us. He's from the Maritimes, and he said he heard some rumblings that some shit's going on. And then Vass Nevada gave me a call and said that there's been a meeting set up and pretty much the whole crew's been invited, and that he's pretty worried that it doesn't look like they got a money backer, and looks like a lot of guys might be leaving, and that's how I found out. And I guess they had their meeting, and then one day at Chalmers, they all came in one by one and said, I want to get my notice, I'm going to be working for the new promotion, and shook my hand, and I just shook everyone's hand and said, well, good luck, and hopefully you get whatever you promised. And I don't know if they were about everything they were promised, but I'm sure some guys made out okay with the short run when John New was in charge.
What was your mindset at the time? Were you hurt by this, or were you kind of angry and fired up and ready to go to war with yet another company?
I was devastated. I put my heart and soul to that, and I took it personally. I took it very personally. And now I realize back then everybody would have been crazy not to go. Like, I would have went. There was a millionaire guy, and he's putting all his money into it, and they promised, from what I told, they promised quite a bit. Like, they were going to be the next WWE, is what they were told. And, of course, that's not going to happen with anybody, but...
Is there anyone specifically more than anyone else that you were disappointed or surprised to see go, or that hurt a little bit more than others?
No, not really. It was business, and I'm surprised. I'm very surprised that they didn't just take the whole crew to put me right out of business. But they left like eight guys, just enough so I could keep running. Now, luckily, I got some guys that came into the Maritimes to work. You know, Scott Savage and Lincoln Steen came in for a while, and then Vince Austin came in. No, Vince Austin wasn't earlier, but Lincoln Steen and Scott Savage came in, so that gave me two extra good hands. And then we were sort of bringing in some Calgary guys and Saskatchewan guys and whatever, so to keep us going. But I'm surprised that he didn't just take my whole crew and just leave me with nothing and say, "See you later, Bobby." But they let me hang on for a little while anyway.
Well, there was definitely some dirty and underhanded tactics as they actually got their ring from you. How did Premier Championship Wrestling go about getting their ring for their events from their competitor?
Well, what happened was when I was running the Cavalier for a while, but I needed a smaller ring, so I built a second ring, and it was really low to the ground. And then after that Gertie, like I said earlier, Gertie Todd kind of kiboshed that that he'd run out the gate there, so we started running there, and then so I had two rings. But I figured this one ring, if it was sitting low to the ground, I could put pillars on it, so I could adjust it, make it higher or lower, so I did that. But I now had a second ring, and I kind of made it to put it out there that I'd be willing to sell it. So I guess they set up some guy that I didn't know to come down and say he needed it for a boxing ring. And so they made a deal with me, and I sold it to him for $3,500, which is okay for me, because it cost me about $4,000 to build it, and I used it for like 2 years, so I pretty much had a ring for free for 2 years, and it was kind of weird, because when I loaded it, I met this guy, Mike Silver, and then I met John Newman, and they got me to deliver it to some storage shed on Pembina Highway, and Then I said to them, John, I said, if you want, I could show you how to set it up one time. Like, I would be nice, but hey, I'm not just going to drop the ring up. No, we'll figure it out. I'm thinking, how could they figure it out? Like, it's impossible for them just to figure it out. It's because they already had the whole crew that didn't want to set up the ring. And TJ Brad had helped me do it. I bought him some beers or whatever, bought him pizza or whatever. Me, TJ Brad, I really didn't give him that much money ever, cash-wise, but I took care of him, and he took care of me in ways. And so as soon as we dropped the ring off, I think we went to eat, and I sat there and looked at him and said, why do I have this feeling I've sold the ring to Mike Davidson? and he goes, oh, you're paranoid. And he goes, I just have this weird feeling. And then sure enough, I was right. And to this day, people still tell me, and Brad denies it, but they say Brad was in on it and knew all along what was going on.
So was the ring purchased before their initial meeting?
No, it was, but I don't know the timeline. No, it was before the meeting, for sure.
Before the meeting, so you don't know if TJ Bratt was involved.
Right, yeah, because I didn't, because I sold the ring, but I didn't know nobody had quit him yet, so or then I would have been suspicious.
What does your gut tell you? Was TJ Bratt involved with the purchase?
Yes. And I think he was, because he jumped ship. He was one of the guys that jumped ship. Or was he? Yeah, he was on the, he was one of the guys that jumped ship.
Yeah, he was but a part of the original crew.
Yes, and people have said that. Like, why would people make that up?
So was there hard feelings towards Bratt once that purchase happened and he made the jump to PCW? How did that affect your friendship?
Well, it was business, eh? Like, I was sad. Like, I was sad like that everybody quit. Like, what could I do? Like, and now, like, back at it, they're, like I said, they did what was best for them. Like, every wrestler is an individual contractor. They do what's best for themselves.
So you had to go to war once again. Now it's with Premier Championship Wrestling. They've got some backers. They're running big shows. They're bringing in big names. What was your mindset going to war with them? Were you ready to do it the same way you did with CWF, who was still operating at the time as well? So I guess there's three companies in the marketplace trying to run shows. What was your approach?
Well, actually, it was funny because the first month that everybody quit, it was like in the wintertime, I had my best month ever. Like, I guaranteed everybody was getting paid well. It was like the best month ever, but I had such a small crew, which was good for them because they were all getting paid a little more, because now I didn't have 30 guys with their hands out. I only had like 8 or 10. So the first month was good, and then my top 8 or 10 guys, I could run a good show. Like, I could go put a spot show on, which you're going to get to the story later on about how me and you kind of had a tip years ago. I don't know if you could ask about it, but I'll get into it. But my top 8 or 10 guys would put on a good show. But when it was time to run like Chalmers every week or Angles, I didn't have that depth. Like, there was, you need like 12, 14 guys, 18 guys, whatever, just to run a solid series of shows at a place. You can't just run it with the same 8 guys. So after a while, I just got disheartened. Like, at first, I tried, and it's like, you know what? I'm looking at these matches, and I'm having 2 or 3 good matches and several not-so-good matches every night. And my heart just slowly was going, getting out of it.
So this eventually led to a surprise to everyone in the local wrestling scene. You then teamed up with the Canadian Wrestling Federation, who invaded Top Rope Championship Wrestling. How did you go from being at war to being in bed with Ernie Todd and the CWF?
Well, I guess both of our talent pools were so thinned out that we were both in the same boat, where we really both could put on a solid show. So if we combined our resources, we could get enough guys there to make it so we could have at least a passable show. So I figured I'd make a deal with the devil, and we'll just move forward with this for a while. And the writing was already on the wall. I knew that the end was coming near.
What was it like working with Ernie at that point? Was it a friendly relationship?
That was fine.
So when it came to TRCW versus CWF matches and angles and such, was there any discrepancy on who's going over or who would be working with who, or was there one person making that decision?
It was my decision. It was my shows, and yeah, no, there was no problems there at all.
So as you mentioned, you know, you're starting to get disheartened and you saw the writing on the wall. What was the final nail in the coffin that made you decide to close Top Rope Championship Wrestling?
Well, contrary to what Shane Maston always says, he and PCW did not put me out of business. It might have had a little bit of a hand in it, or a part of a hand, or maybe half of a hand in putting me out. But the bottom line was, it was a combination of just not making any money, seeing that I can't put on top quality matches that I would really like to put out there for someone to get their bang for their buck, and the fact that my wife was now expecting our second child. She was on maternity leave for the first part of the, like, my daughter was born in 2000, and in early 2001, that was right when TRCW was going strong. So she was on maternity leave, but then she went off maternity leave. So at one point, I was driving around, postering pole with my daughter in a baby seat in the back seat, and I'd get out of the car, was traffic around, post her a pole, get back in, drive, give her a bottle or whatever. And I was just thinking, what the hell am I doing here? Like, and then all of a sudden, my wife became pregnant with our second child. And so she was pregnant, and I just said, you know what? I can't do this anymore. I'm going to have two kids, two babies. I'm married. I don't even see my wife much. And I just said, this is it. I'm not making any money. I've got a good crew, a good enough crew, I should say, to run the same shows and my family. And I just said, you know what, I've had enough.
So you ended up running there's been small spot shows since, but what was technically the last Top Rope Championship Wrestling show was at Chalmers as a farewell. What are some of your memories of that show, as a lot of the talent from PCW and from the other organization that jumped ship did come together for one night of professional wrestling action? How did that all come to be, and how did you negotiate that to get everybody in the same building for one night?
I believe I put it out on the message board saying it would be my last show, and if anybody ever worked at PCW is welcome to come back and do it. I'd welcome with open arms, and then they got the blessing from Andrew at PCW and Mike or whoever's in charge, and they approached me one by one, and pretty much almost the whole crew was there. We ended up having like a 50-man battle royal, and the place was just jam-packed. To this day, I should have charged more than $5 to get in. It back then it was $5 to get in, and I could have made some money for once. But actually, all the guys offered to work the show out of their own pocket, so I'd have to payroll one night, so they actually let me make some money for the final night. But the place was just packed. Like, I mean, you couldn't even move. It was good. I put a lot of tag teams back together, some groups back together, and it was fun. It was a really fun night. I'm just appreciate that everyone came back for one last night to give me a send off as the last official TRCW show.
So now that TRCW is all wrapped up and done, what was the change? Like, that must have been a big change to your life. You went from running, 10, 12 shows a month, being on the road, being very busy. What was that adjustment like, going back to everyday life without the wrestling business?
Well, actually, right around then, my Sponge Hockey League was taken. I run a Sponge Hockey League as well, and that was starting to get bigger and bigger, so I started dedicating more time to that. And then as well, I run my baseball league, so... that was getting bigger and better, and then that was the addition of my second child, and I just enjoyed family life with my wife and kids, and then I did the odd wrestling show, but it was nice to just not have to worry about going out and postering and worrying about how many people are going to show up and how much money am I going to lose. So it was nice just to get away.
You were also involved with some other companies after your time in Top Rope Championship Wrestling. Mike Davidson ended up branching off of PCW. That seems to be a trend. Someone's not happy, they leave and they branch off and start their own operation.
You're breaking up.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yeah.
So Mike Davidson started Action Wrestling Entertainment, and they ran their first event at the Investors Group Athletic Center. You were involved with the finances of that event, or that weekend, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, what happened was, I heard Mike was doing this, and I guess I either coached him or he coached. Then he asked me if I could use my ring. They had a show out in Steinbach, and they wanted me to use my ring, so I made a deal with them for that. And then I was going to be on the show, that show, and I guess the big show at the Dutchess Group Athletic Center. And then they needed a third show with Rikishi at Hacksaw Jim Duggan. I guess they promised them three shows as part of their package. So I said, well, you know what? I'll run Black the Body. I'll do that social gimmick, the one that Johnny Bo, where I'll do a wrestling show, and then we'll do a social. Just out of town, and I don't feel like we should leave them alone on that one. So what I did is I told Mike, I said, here's the deal. I'll give you a guarantee. I'll pay you certain amount of money, and that'll pay for all the crews, including Rikishi and Hacksaw Jim Duggan and all of the crew. I said, but I'm going to use Zach Mercury and PJ Brad that aren't on your crew, and I will pay them. Other than that, and I'll pay myself, so you don't have to pay me anything. And I will supply the ring, and all you do is you out of that money, you got to pay all the talent, and you can supply a ring crew. And he said, yeah, no problem. So we get out there, and I end up bombing. Like, I end up losing $3,000 on the show.
Wow.
As soon as Mike gets there, I hand him his money for whatever deal it was, and he's supposed to pay everybody out of that. So all of a sudden, the doors are about to open, Jim Duggan and Rikishi were sitting there in the front row, and they won't go to the back. And what's going on is, And they said, well, we were waiting for our money. So I was at Mike. He said, I paid you guys. Why are you paying? They said, well, we're still waiting for all our visa money to come through, Ticketmaster money to come through. So we haven't got enough money to pay him from last night, like for the all three shots or two shots or whatever it was. But they needed them to do it. So they said, can we borrow some money just so we can pay them? And so then, I think they're short like $800 or something. I said, well, how about I give you $1,200 so you can take care of some of the crew? So they said, okay. So I gave them $1,200 so that we do the show, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Show Bob. There's about 100 people. They're a hot crowd, but 100 people. But I've got to draw like way more than that to break even. So I lose my shirt, but they get their pay. I pay my brat and I pay Merck. And all the rest of the guys are supposed to be getting paid. They're all waiting around. I said, where's Mike? I said, I don't know. They took off without paying any of the guys. And they're all looking at me thinking it's my show. I said, no, he's supposed to pay you out of his pay. I gave him a guarantee for this.
Come to think of it, I recall not getting paid on that event. That all makes sense now.
Yeah. So they owe me $1,200. So a couple days later, Jeff Dick brings me a check for $1,200. Okay, no problem. They pay me. It bounces. So I'm livid. Like, I'm trying to get a hold of them. Apparently, when I'm calling, they're laughing at my voicemails and everything. So finally, Mike actually does pay me the $1,200 cash. I would take another check. That was a couple months down the road, but I was like on the message boards and really burying them. Not that they cared, probably. They probably laughed about that too. But the Mike did pay me. But to this day, I should actually put it on Facebook. I've got the check. I've got the check. I've still got it in my possession. When they actually, that's my experience with Action Wrestling or Entertainment or whatever they were called.
Well, I'm sure every person in Winnipeg or every second person in Winnipeg has one of those bounce checks kicking around.
Yep, sure.
So during your time after Top Rope Championship Wrestling, you were involved with some of these promotions. You went back and did some sporadic work for River City Wrestling, and during that time, you actually introduced your son into the business, Colton Jay, and yes. It was not without controversy as he was very young at the time. What prompted the decision to get him involved with professional wrestling, and why is he no longer doing it?
Well, when he was young, he used to love watching wrestling, and then in my basement, he started doing some flips and learning how to do moonsaults and stuff. So he started taking gymnastics, and he was unbelievable the stuff he could do. He had a trampoline at home, and he started doing gymnastics, and so it was kind of my idea. I asked him if he wanted to do it, wear a mask, and he said he would do it. So I did some stuff with Wade, and with a lot of controversy, I'm sure, but Wade loves that stuff, so he ate it up. And we did a little angle where I was the pushy dad, where I was telling him I was getting mad at him for doing screw-ups in the ring, like he used to do one extra flip, and then I tell him to pin the guy, and then he'd go do one more moonsault, the guy would move and then pin him, and I'd be pushing him around and saying, you listen to your dad and all this, and we ended up having a father-son match, and it was a really good match, and at the end, I apologized to him after he went over, because we had sat for the Murphy to come and save him, but I was going to hit him with a chair or something, and then it was a really good angle, and so my son loved it for a while, but he's a really, really shy kid, and I'll get a backtrack, actually. After we did this, Tony, he actually did a couple shows in the States. Buck Zumoff needed a midget, so we went down to the States, me and him, and my son worked as a midget as a heel in bar shows, screaming, as a heel, and I'd probably be laughing. How old is that little kid? It was so hilarious watching him work as a heel in a bar. He did two shows with Buck, and after the show, he went upstairs doing his homework in the locker room while we're all sitting drinking beers in the bar. So that was quite humorous, actually.
So why is he no longer in the business?
The reason he's on the business, well, he's really, really a really shy kid, and I guess a lot of his friends aren't into wrestling, but what really made him stop is we were backstage at that AWE show, and I was introducing him to all the guys, and they were all super cool with him, all the names, and then I introduced him to Billy Gunn, and Billy Gunn said, yeah, it's my son, and he just got into the business. He says, well, get out of the business, in a mean tone voice. My son just had a terrified look, and then after that, he never wrestled again.
Wow.
So I don't know if it was what Billy Gunn said. I know it's a combination of other things, but I think that might have been the final straw, and he just got scared and never wrestled again.
Does he still like wrestling to this day, or is it something he's passed on from?
It's kind of passed on now. Like, he'll watch it once in a while, but he still does the gymnastics and the flips and stuff. So I'd love to get. He's taller than me now. I'd love to get him in the ring with hood on and do his thing again. He would totally amaze everybody with the moves he could do. But he's totally done. He'll never be in the wrestling business again.
We've talked about many relationships you've had over the years, and some guys that have been kind of grouped in as Bobby J guys that, travel together, work closely with you, or guys like TJ Bratt, Rob Stardom, Zach Mercury, Ryan Wood. What's your relationship with these guys years later?
Off and on. The only one that's never been off is with Rob Stardom. We've always been friends. I was the best man at his wedding, and me and him really never had any heat with each other. That we argued on the road a couple times, but everyone does that when you get to 2 years and you get goofy. But other than that, the rest of them have been off and on, and unfortunately, with a couple of them, they're off at the moment, and that's very unfortunate because they were really close friends with me, and I'm not going to get into anything like that right now with what happened, but a couple of my buddies, it's unfortunate that we're just not close anymore.
So now you're currently wrestling with Canadian Wrestling's Elite. You've been with us. You were there for our very first show, and you've wrestled on and off with us for the past 5 years. What are some of your memories and some of your highlights of your CWE tenure?
Well, I had a match with Petey Williams, which everybody was surprised to see me in the ring with him, and I hung in there pretty good with him, considering I'm a lot older and I'm a lot fatter than him. He's a TNA superstar reformer, and he can move, and I think I held myself accountable pretty good then. And then I guess when I was away for quite a while, when I came back and I did a six-way about a year and a half ago, and the ovation I got, that was unbelievable for the crowd, from being a heel for so many years, for them just embrace me. It almost brought a tear to my eye. It was unreal. And now I'm a babyface of the company, and I'm enjoying that spot. And it's kind of cool to see how the people that I healed on for so many years can cheer me now.
And now with Canadian Wrestling, something I've tried to always do with you is, a small criticism people would give is, oh, once you've seen one Bobby J match, you've seen them all. And I'm a firm believer that one match is great. People love your stick. They love the beautiful Bobby J gimmick, and it definitely has its place on any wrestling show. With that being said, I've tried to take that and tried to have you kind of work out of your comfort zone a little bit to offer some extra dimensions and add some layers and depth to beautiful Bobby J. And during your time with CW, you have wrestled the former TNA X Division champion in Petey Williams. You've done ladder matches for CWE, which you've never done before coming over. You've recently wrestled with Chris Masters. What are your feelings towards being asked to work out of your comfort zone? Is it something you embrace, or is it something you want to punch me in the mouth for when I ask you to do?
No, I love it actually, because I think of the challenge, and I think I'm up for the challenge, and I always still throw my Bobby J stuff in there, and then just do some other stuff. So yeah, it's a nice switch actually.
So what's next for beautiful Bobby J? You're on this quest right now, 49 years old. You are claiming you would like to be the oldest champion in CWE history.
Well, that's my goal. I'm gonna keep on training hard and get in there and do as many matches as I can, and hopefully. The championship committee thinks I'm the number one contender someday and gives me that shot, and I'll take advantage.
I like to rib that it isn't the biggest goal, because Robbie Royce is probably Robbie Royce is probably around the same age.
Oh, Robbie Royce is about 10 years younger than me.
Ah, well, you're aging well then, Bob.
Yes, because he started shortly after me, but I started when I was almost 26. He started when he was just turned 18, so we're probably about 8 years apart, actually, I believe.
Wow. So we're going to have some fun now. I would like to ask you something we like to ask on every race show. Instead of your best match and some of your best opponents and all that fun stuff, who was the worst match, or what was the worst match you've ever had and your worst opponent, and why?
Mine was the not-so-great Papito. We had a match at the Ellis Theater that I was so embarrassed. It was the absolute... Anybody who can't do a Bobby J match should get the hell out of the business. And he couldn't even do the easiest spots. Like, I do one-step spots. I don't make complex tackle drop-down, leapfrog, blah, 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 boom. I just do one spot at a time. Maybe two spots into one. And he couldn't even do that. And it's like, you got to be kidding me. And it was, like, the worst match I've ever had. And I've had probably quite a few bad ones. But those are matches... Don't get screwed up because I keep them so simple. But that one got screwed up. His name was Pat.
He actually ranks up there as one of my worst matches of all time, too. Back in 2004, I moved out to Edmonton and was training with the Monster Pro Wrestling Camp for a while and honing my craft there. And it was a really good training camp. I learned and picked up a lot of good stuff while I was there. And when I came back to Winnipeg, my first match back was with Pepito. And it was just dreadful because the guy isn't trained properly. He can't do things, like most trained professionals can in the ring. And I lost my temper and kind of took it out on him a little bit, which was probably unprofessional of me at the time to do looking back at it. But I remember having a ton of heat because it was that same thing. He just could not follow these simplest, easiest of matches. And it ended up kind of turning into a shoot in the ring. And I ended up getting heat for a little while. And I don't think I was booked for a couple months after that. So
yeah, I never took a liberties on it, but I just shook my head and got to the back. And that was the worst I'd ever had.
So we need to book the rematch.
No. We'll just leave it at he is my worst opponent.
Now it's time for the fun part of the program. Bobby, if you listened to our program before, you know I asked this question, so I'm hoping you prepared some fun for us. Ribs, rats, and road stories, Bobby J. You've had a 20-plus year career. What are some road stories from that illustrious career of yours that either involve ribs or rats or both?
All right. I guess when we were up on the Northern Tour, I only actually did one Northern Tour with Tony Condello. He was laying on the gym mat just snoring away, and we were all laughing, and I took a condom. I rolled it out, and I put some air conditioner in it, like cream rinse. And then I put it right by his nose, so when he woke up, he saw it, and he was convinced that I jerked off at him. So he turned the tables on me and made like a rib on me that I actually jerked off into that condom. But so that was a pretty funny rib on Tony. And I don't know, there's just a lot of fun stories. Nothing too major. I guess I'm kind of a boring guy in the road. I just like to have a whole bunch of beers. But I do remember one instance where me, AJ Sanchez, and I think it was Various. We went to Regina for a road trip, and we got just super, super loaded, and it was, a 50-cent draft at the bar until 11 o'clock, and then the bar's closed at 1 or whatever, and then it was $5 beer, so we actually ordered 24 drafts each, the three of us, and the waitress actually brought them to us. We had a picture on Facebook of it, and then if you scroll a couple of pictures later on Facebook, you'll see a big layer of puke, and AJ Sanchez passed out in it. And then I guess another funny Regina story is I guess I was with AJ. I don't know who else I was with. And we had to go to the bathroom. We stopped at the gas station, and I had to take a dump. So a bad one. From drinking the night before, you always have the bad shit. So we went to the one where it was a single stall where it was like unisex one. So I went in and I had to take this killer dump. So when I walk out, it was beautiful hot chick waiting to go next to her. Oh my god. So she has to go in there. So we go in there, we gas up, and then we watch her walk out, and she just got this disgusted look on her face, just shaking her head and roaring, laughing. Yeah, that was pretty funny. Oh, I got another one. I got a guy, now they're starting to come up. We did a show at a place called Franz's Bar. It's in Steinbach. And a wrestler that I won't say his name, but his first name rhymes with flying, and his last name rhymes with could. But I won't say his name. But anyway, rumors had it that we had a room to change in, so we're all in the bar after. So they did a gimmick where it was like 7 to 9, we had the wrestling, and then they cleared the ring, and then it was jam-packed, and it was like a really good night. It was like a hot chick, a dance bar, whatever. So it was a Saturday night. Rumor has it that this wrestler that I did not name was banging some rat in the dressing room. So I was really? So I've got a key to the room, so let's go crash this party. So we opened the door, and he's just pumping his chick, and we all just jumped on him with big frog splashes and everything. I just killed his wood. that's about it. There's a few more, but that. I think that's good.
Yeah, we'll save those for another time. Bobby, if fans want to get in contact with you, what's your social media handles?
Look me up under Bobby J. St. Laurent. Bobby J. St. Laurent on Facebook. You'll find me. I'm all over Facebook. I'm a Facebooker.
Or venture to the Spike on a Friday or Saturday night.
That's right. You can always see me every second of the weekend at the Silver Spike Saloon. Free plug for them. Buy me a paralyzer, but just give me a because I'm going to die in.
Bobby, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. It was a blast having you on, and I look forward to having you again on in the future.
And yeah, I just want to say a few things about you, Danny, first, before we go into our time.
Definitely.
I got to get to the story about how me and Danny kind of sort of met. I'm not sure if you remember. I'm sure you do. Danny was about 14 years old, weighing in at about a buck, buck 10 maybe?
Maybe. That's a little generous.
Yep. Soaking wet with a roll of quarters in your pocket. And I guess you started out, I guess you're working with Wayne or whatever, and you're taking ring jackets and whatever, and you want to get the business. And I guess you're befriending PCW at that point. And I remember me and you getting into warm words on an MSN Messenger. That was a cool thing back then. And I guess you saved the conversation, and you said brought it to Andrew that we meet him at some heat. So I didn't like you at that point. and then Wayne was going to have a shirt. Was using my ring. Actually, I was right about the point.
I do remember this.
Wayne was using my ring, and that's when PCW saw it, and they were going to buy a ring off me. So it was right around that time. And I told Wayne that I don't want Danny Duggan in the ring. He's underage, and he's been disrespectful to me. And you did a shoot run-in or something, or some kind of a run-in, and there was all this crazy stuff. I think you ran out of the building or something.
I was booked in a run-in. I remember you saying you didn't want me in the ring. Because I was supposed to do a spot with Corey Diamond, and you said you didn't want me in the ring, so it was kiboshed, but then somebody came back to me and said it was a go. So I think they booked it, maybe as a rib on both of us.
I bet you Wayne did that, just to make me ruffle my feathers, just to see how I react, because that's what Wayne wants to do.
Yeah, so I was told it was a go. I was told it was a go, so I did the run-in in the match, and the next thing I know, I've got Wayne throwing me out of the building. And he was hot, and then him and Andrew actually got into it really good. I thought they were going to get into a fight.
Yeah, that was funny. That was the good old days. But I'd just like to say you've come a long way, Danny, since that young little skinny kid. I'm very proud of your progress. And I'd say after that, it was the hardest working wrestler in Canada in his time, and you were definitely the hardest working wrestler in Canada today. And hopefully you get what's coming to you, and you get your big break and make a good living in this business, and don't forget about beautiful Bobby J.
Bobby, no matter how big or small I make it in this business, I'll always be coming on over for a pool party come summertime.
Are you still going to give me the $10 for saying that?
Yep.
Yes. No, seriously though, Danny, you're really good for the business, and I really hope that you make a living at this, because you're really hardworking and you're a great worker, and you're doing everything right in this business, and hopefully it comes back to give you rewards.
Thanks a lot, Bob, and I appreciate you being on board and being involved with Canadian Wrestling's Elite and having this get to the next level here in the province of Manitoba. It's really a pleasure to have you on board.
Yeah, it's been a blast, and it continue to be a blast, and hopefully that title comes my way, because I'm beautiful Bobby J.
The year is young.
Sounds good.
All right,
thanks,
Bobby.
Thanks for having me, and take care, and as always, you've been an excellent host.
And that's another edition of Elite Wrestling Radio. Thank you, beautiful Bobby J. We'll be back next Wednesday night with our next guest. Thanks for tuning in.
Saw all the